Hello, everyone. Welcome to our live edition of the Out of the Woods Thrill Hunting Podcast. So this episode is going to be a special episode. We've done some Guess Who editions in the past. And basically, the Guess Who editions are where we try to cover, typically in the past, an actor, the behaviors, the things they do, things they're known for, and see if throughout the podcast or episode, people are able to guess successfully. This one's slightly different because we actually are picking a malware family to kind of cover in this episode. So we'll be kind of doing the same thing. But what's really important is one, if you have a guess, don't put it in any of the live chats because we want to kind of make it fun for everybody. We only accept the first few submissions that get it right to win. Reward. And you only can answer one. So your first guess is going to be basically the one we accept. So make sure it's a good one. And we'll reveal everything at the end of this episode. So you'll be able to at least walk away knowing who we're talking about. But before we dive into all of that, we'll do some quick introductions for anyone that is new. I'm Scott Poley. I'm a principal threat hunter at Intel 471, one of the consistent hosts of this podcast, which we do on a semi-weekly basis to try to cover down on how to threat hunt and how to think about all the different stuff happening out in the world. Feel free to reach out to me on LinkedIn. I love discussions, questions and stuff I get there. I am slow to respond because I do actually look at everybody that wants to connect with me. I'm always interested in who they are and so I'm a little slow to some of those things, but I'll pass it off to Lee next.
Hey, how's it going, everyone? So I'm Lee Arcanal, a principal threat on account manager here in Intel 471. Past history you can find on LinkedIn as well. So again, like Scott here, I'm always open to connect and talk to like-minded individuals. Or if you're not a like-minded individual, you know, challenge my thinking, you know, I'm open for discussion as well. That's always great. But yeah, find me on LinkedIn, and I'll pass it to Tom.
Hello everybody, I'm Tom Kostura. I'm a threat hunter here at Intel 471, also Moonlight as an account manager as well. And yeah, just pretty much echoing what these guys said, we love talking shop. This is part of the fun for us for the podcast. I get to luckily I get to be Scott's trusty sidekick on the week to week show. So I really enjoy doing this. We all love talking shop, so absolutely reach out to all of us and by myself, I'm on LinkedIn as well. So please reach out.
Yeah, so kicking that off, feel free, ask questions, make comments and so forth, in the chat. We'll monitor those and we'll try to bring things said into the conversation as well. So the people that aren't directly watching chat will be able to hear and kind of participate as well. Tom, do you want to kind of break out kind of the malware family piece of this?
Yeah, so what we're looking at here, and this may sound redundant, but just making sure that we kind of set the stage, right? So when we talk about malware or malware families, we're talking about kind of that collection of the software or the variants of that software or the code that's associated with a specific given malware. It doesn't matter the target. We're not necessarily giving away the target or the specific actors that use the malware. We're just gonna talk about the malware slash malware family because I think this particular one will bucket into both. In consideration when thinking about this, and as we're gonna kind of go through these slides and talk about these different areas for this malware. One of the things that's constant and common is malware tends to evolve, especially when you kind of associate it with this malware family kind of bucket. It's constantly evolving, changing, alternating the code base, alternating just some of the behaviors or the things it's going after, finding new ways to be effective, depending on what the overall goal is. Scott and Lee, I'm going to be doing my best to not give it away. That was a part
Not
I've been
understand.
worried about this whole time, is like not saying the thing. But yeah, so really we're just going to be the whole scope is focused specifically in that area. So again, we're talking malware specific, malware family specific, no actor based, no regional based, no specific targeted industry, none of that. We're going to be looking at just the malware, what it does, how it operates, how it's evolved, and hopefully it gives some strong clues. And just as a hint, there are some pretty unique, relatively unique pieces for this particular malware family throughout the talk and presentation. So just a little nugget to start it off to help people get going.
Yeah, I went the opposite way. I gathered as much general information as possible to just muddy the water.
It's malware.
Yeah,
so the one thing I wanted to add, I don't know if the people listening have the experience of actually looking through almost like that time lapse of how malware evolves. But the one cool thing about when you think about threat hunting and malware and behaviors is definitely at points in time, malware is relatively static, especially with some of the behaviors. And what's also interesting to see what behaviors don't change as it evolves. But because it's typically written in code, the nice thing is a lot of times capabilities are added and a lot of them aren't taken away. So when you actually understand some of the core behaviors of malware, they're actually really easy and consistent and reliable to hunt for. Versus an actor where, if an actor comes across in your environment, if they happen to be there, you have some controls that they didn't see in previous breaches that you've studied and learned from. They may behave differently, right? Because they'll adapt to that. Malware is a little different. So as we kind of go through that, think about that as far as, when we talk about some of the threat hunting strategies and things that we look at as kind of higher fidelity in a sense, I guess. But yeah, just food for thought.
We always echo on the show the kind of common behaviors and go after the behaviors, making sure, tracking the things that people are using all the time, right? Scott, your favorite, single character executable files. That's stuff that we see in the malware, which has been fun going through the research part of this episode, is really identifying that kind of stitch where, like, that thing that we constantly preach, it falls inside of the malware, the code that's being run, not necessarily by the actor's behaviors. But the code behaviors, is that's where the consistency is and those high fidelity things are, like you just said. But it's been really cool seeing that through this with more depth, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And I would be curious, sorry to cut you off, Lee, is like how many people, when they address malware, typically look for IOCs, because that's very common with malware, right? Like hashes, maybe some of the C2 indicators and things like that. So we're definitely not necessarily taking that approach at all here, just so everyone understands that.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely not. And what I was going to say is it's always fun to see what behaviors are consistent until they stop working. Because to be real, if you think about the malware, even if it does evolve over time and capabilities are added, those core behaviors may be able to direct you. Because, why would they keep using them if they don't work anymore? And
right.
All right. Well, let's kick it off with kind of some of the first pieces here for malware. We're going to talk... kind of the initial entry, like where this starts with, right? So, you kind of have a couple kind of key areas. It really starts with that user-driven side, like we always know, okay? We're saying something pretty standard, pretty common knowledge, but it is important because this is going to stack into a lot of the commonalities for this specific malware. The delivery methods usually follow one of three paths, right? You're looking at a malicious zip or an ISO file being delivered typically through phishing, or from a link from a website or a link that's staged in the phishing email, but generally through that vector. Sometimes it's also delivered as a fake update, fake software update, or a specific tool you might be interested in or going after. And then in more recent versions of delivery of this malware, it's gone into the leveraging the click fix style social engineering, right? Some of the initial payload, it's typically sitting with this specific malware most of the time with some kind of an LNK file or an installer like binary to kind of masquerade. But I'll let you guys jump in and expand a little bit.
Yeah, so one of the interesting things about this specific family was it was really started to seem mostly active starting around like the mid 2022. So it's been around for some time. And the initial vectors of how it gets in, it seems to commonly bundle with other droppers. So it's kind of a malware that's not always the initial stage. And there's been a few instances in some reporting where it actually becomes almost like a dropper for other things, which I thought was weird because it typically in most cases doesn't perform that way. There is something I want to talk about, but I don't want to talk about this early because I don't want to give it away. But I do believe that this family, from some of the stuff I was kind of reading and kind of thinking about, may have been kind of the initial driver for the click fix style attack. And I'll talk about that a little later to expand upon that because I don't want to give too much away. And hopefully it will make sense to everybody else. But I thought it was kind of fascinating thinking about it that way because ClickFix, I mean, it's kind of emerged and it's surprisingly stuck around for a long time. I think the big question is security people were addressing ClickFix was like, well, who's going to copy and paste things and run with them? As a vector and clearly that works, right? But
Wow.
the way I initially saw the stuff, it was really interesting. But some of the things, because they're using ClickFix style prompts and stuff like that, PowerShell becomes a big mechanism, right, for how this actually gets delivered, because you're pasting a lot of PowerShell specific commands, so there's going to be some base 64 encoding associated with some of the PowerShell, because your people are pasting in commands that way. Ironically, there is a lot of MSHTA chaining. So a lot of that initial access stuff, you'll see PowerShell actually being executed either via ClickFix or whatever other method. And it actually will call MSHTA to download a JavaScript payload. To kind of carry out some of its initial avenues of attack associated with it. So something to kind of think on. The earliest style attacks, they actually were using MS Build for some pieces, and they also used MSI exec as some of the earlier methods to use MSI exec to actually run the payload specifically. So they've definitely adopted many avenues, but I feel like delivery avenues, when you think of malware, they all kind of touch the same telemetry in a lot of ways. So it's not the biggest giveaway, but just thinking about that, there are some reliable ways, and I would say most recently, ClickFix seems to fit that, right? So.
And looking at this family as well, there's actually and again, to try and muddy the water, there's actually a lot of other initial vectors too. So it was once delivered via Discord. We had GitHub was able or was part of the infection chain at one point. And crack software. I mean, who doesn't get excited about free software that normally costs like a couple $100, right? I mean, just a heads up, if you get free software, it's probably not free. You're probably giving away something. And to go back to what Bully said earlier, brain took a dirt road. Hold on. I'll get back to it maybe. But there's a point you said that I was gonna. Oh, don't be surprised if this whole new click fix shows up on your yearly cybersecurity awareness training. Because it's running rampant. People need to be aware of it. I mean, I know we're all aware of it, but.
Yeah, it kind of has to, right? It's still mind-blowing that it works. I'll never understand fully how it's so effective, but it is, and it's continuing to evolve. And we just even this week, I think there was a couple other new variants of style of ClickFix that were talked about in some of the intel that we were ingesting. But yeah, I think too, if my research was correct, which I'm very much going to leave open that I might have missed something, because I certainly couldn't research every malware family. This malware family, I think, was also one of the first kind of adopters, from what I could scrape, as far as using that, the kind of like the dual extension file kind of delivery, right? So a PDF, like a dot PDF dot link type delivery. So just a little nugget there. All right, let's kind of press on a bit. So Scott, you started diving into a bit of the execution side of things. So just kind of on the forefront, you did talk about the MSI. We can expand on that a little bit. PowerShell. There's a couple commands here on screen that are direct pulls from activity from this malware family, though it tried to hopefully not give anything away in there. But yeah, the execution change, kind of what you were alluding to. You're gonna see pretty standard stuff here. But there is the variations of kind of over time how this has gone to maybe give a clue for how long this malware family has been around. Code obfuscation, common, super common. Executing code in line, super common with this malware family. But yeah, Scott, you started kind of branching into this. You want to dive in a little more here?
Yeah, so I mean, when we talk about especially like the QuickFix approaches and stuff, when we say something uses PowerShell, I know some people probably are just like, yeah, that's great. A lot of things use PowerShell. How is that going to help me? Obviously, paying attention to what PowerShell is actually doing is going to be a big part of that. As you can see, some of the examples kind of provided visually here. Obviously, PowerShell is used to actually download things. And in this case, they're using the new object, like the system.net.web client way, defining that network client object. And they also are running hidden windows, specifically with PowerShell, doing execution bypass. Those are very common executions from attackers and malware, right? And even the downloading mechanism. So that's pretty commonly shared. The MSI execution, that's interesting because that's after you've already kind of downloaded something based on the example that was provided in the resources, right? So you can actually execute MSI exec and point it to a remote destination to run something. But the examples, whatever social engineering happened beforehand, convince someone to download a package that looked like a system update and then run it locally. And I'll kind of explain more because that kind of leads into what I was actually going to talk about a little later without getting too much of a reveal. The other thing is, and it was interesting because it was a case where there was some execution with command prompts with some interesting arguments. And this was a case where this malware family kind of coexisted with other malware, either by dropping it, or there was actually through the campaign that was being tracked by this reporting, they saw almost two different variants of the same malware. So when you talked about variants, and they use command prompt with the slash, the forward slash D, forward slash S, and then forward slash C command arguments in the chain. What's interesting about that, obviously the forward slash C, everyone's kind of used to seeing that. And I think it's a good thing to even be looking for in general, just to understand what's actually running command arguments through command prompt. So that's basically passing whatever you're gonna, what command you want to pass the command prompt. So the forward slash C is a common thing. But the forward slash S modifies how command strings is parsed, especially when there's quotes. So I think it helps like strip quotes specifically. It can run, or is that silent? I'm trying to remember
Hit
now.
the slash S was silent.
It's silent. Yeah, you're right. I'm reading like two different things on the screen. Yeah, so that's the run silent mode, right? So like you don't necessarily see something come up. And then there is the slash D. And where are my notes for that? But that's uniquely different too. Make sure I got this right. But looking for that pattern, like when you see chain command arguments like that, it's like a huge signature, which is worth paying attention to, right? So I would pay attention to things like that. That's kind of a huge thing. And especially since that was used to with multiple malware. Something to be said is this malware family is malware as a service. And the original authors that contributed to this malware family were of Russian origin, based on some of the language pattern matching stuff. So that being said, it's very common for it to be kind of bundled with other family malware families being leveraged, just because you're trying to basically leverage different code base to achieve your objective, and you might have kind of hooks and ties into other groups and malware that you can leverage. So make sure I get the slash D argument. You guys can go on. I'm going to try to make sure I get the right thing for the slash D, because my notes were incorrect about that.
So one of the reasons why I made sure to kind of touch on PowerShell, because you even said it, and I'm comfortable, and I'll always take the brunt for this. When we talk about threat hunting specifically, or looking to protect our environment, understanding like the very common behaviors, it's a reason why we tend to echo them, and we'll always echo them. I'll feel comfortable doing that forever. I love, and we're even in the middle, our team as a whole is in the middle of doing some research for net new stuff where there's possibility for more of those complex correlations, or the more complex kind of multi-staged hunts, right? And those are fantastic. And we tend to, I think security professionals tend to want to go to that place to find that very specific, that golden nugget, that needle in a haystack thing, which is great. But you should always kind of circle back and always kind of check yourself and your processes to make sure, are you doing the basics? So it's one thing too to know that a malware may use PowerShell. It's another thing to make sure that you have stuff in place to constantly track those things, or you're constantly considering those things. Very simple stuff like PowerShell commands running with a hidden window, using the execution policy bypass stuff, running them in like in this command to pull something to pull a payload down from the web. These are basic things that are so common. So making sure that you don't forget about these commonality ones that are big bang for buck, track a whole lot of bad, are pretty close to always being suspicious. Even in an environment that may use that pretty heavily, it's pretty easy to whitelist that stuff out, right? Lee, I know you've done a lot of trainings, talked and worked through a lot of that to be able to whitelist common activity in your environment out while still using that general hunt to find bad stuff beyond that, right? So it's not hard things to do. But yeah, just something that I think is very important. And this malware was a prime example of it, because it's the PowerShell usage is absolute in almost every variant way and thing it's doing. And I don't think I've seen a piece of intelligence around the research for this specific malware family where it didn't involve PowerShell and some of these basic commands.
And two artifacts and kind of red flags I want to point out on this example, because these are things I always point out as well. And they're, like Tom said, they're not absolute, but they could be an indicator that something suspicious or malicious is going on. If you look at the first PowerShell example, you see it's running from the syswow 64 directory. What that tells me is that this is a 64-bit box, and then some 32-bit program executed PowerShell. So syswow 64 is all, which is kind of backwards. So system 32 on a 64-bit box, that's the 64-bit living off LAN binaries. Syswow 64 captures all the 32-bit binaries or LOL bins on a 64-bit. So seeing syswow 64, while it is common in some environments, whether it be like legitimate activity, you're in an environment where a script was created years ago or a program was created years ago, and for cross compatibility, you know, it's just stayed the same as a 32-bit program, and it just runs from the syswow 64. Great, that's fine. But if you see a lot of the things that are happening with system 32, and then all of a sudden you see a syswow 64 pop up, that could be an indicator. Also, looking at the MSI execution, look at the name of the file. It's Windows System-Update.msi. Clearly, and we know, you know, because we're researching this, but masquerading is a game that adversaries play all the time as well. So not only are they trying to get you to help out and feel empowered by using the click fix, you know, initial access vector, but they're also, you know, trying to entice you by giving you free software. And then on top of that, they're naming their files legitimately so that you can say, oh, hey, this is just a Windows system update. Let me go. Boom. And I'll just follow it, get it installed and go. And I hate to, I'm not trying to fear monger or aiming, but whenever you look at things like this, it's not just a single check the box and say, yes, this is okay to run this. It the actors know this, and they will pile as many techniques as possible to try and get you to execute this somehow. So just always think about, like, what is this? And those are also things to hunt for, is, you know, windows or files that are named masquerading or are named to masquerade different things.
Yeah, the this is why I was tripping up, because I was looking at something different with the slash D argument for the command prompt. But, and this is interesting in itself, because if you think about threat actors trying to find other ways of persistence, we always talk about registered run keys. Well, the slash D prevents auto run keys that kick off when command prompt executes. And so people can put custom scripts and things. And I shared the registry's keys in Discord, but there is, depending on the user hive or the machine hive, there's the Microsoft command processor auto run. And so those are interesting keys that could probably use against you. They didn't specifically use them here, but they wanted to make sure that whatever was auto run there wouldn't interfere with what they're trying to execute. So it's just an interesting note, for interesting keys to potentially pay attention to in general, right? So I think, you know, that's why that part is pretty key and interesting.
There's another one too that I think kind of falls inside of the execution, but also kind of trails back, like, prior to, like, the technical execution stage, right? It's more in the payload delivery. This goes along with the clickfix style stuff, right? So there's run registry key. It's basically like current version Explorer run MRU. This registry key actually tracks, I think it's 25 or 26. It'll hold 25 or 26 of the most recent commands that are, like, executed in, like, the run dialog box. So when you see those commands executed there, it's updated. That registry key gets updated, which creates signal for you to track, you know, I guess, execution or that initial payload delivery, to kind of see more of that click fix style, you know, entry point or method. And it's pretty commonly tracked. I do not believe there is some in-depth policy, right, you need to do to see this. You should be able to see it in common Windows event logs, both the security log side and Sysmon. I believe it's Sysmon event 13. And from my research, both events will track the command that was executed or added to that register key that was run in that run dialog box. So pretty good telemetry, pretty good signal for you. So just something to drop out there too for hunting.
Yeah.
And all right. I guess I don't have more. And I meant to say, looking at the command execution, a tall tale or a key sign that says this is user driven. If you ever, like, trying to, you know, look at root cause or anything, explorer.exe, opening up command.exe that's executing PowerShell. That tells me that a user opened up Explorer to find command.exe and then executed the PowerShell. This is a real good indicator of, like, the click fix, where the person sees on their screen, they say, okay, follow these directions, open this up and run. So another great indicator to look for.
Yeah, it's like we always talk on a weekly basis. We look at actors, malware, all sorts of attacks, and that script interpreter chaining is what I commonly refer to it as, where if you've got command prompt, PowerShell, MSHTA, WScript, any one of those kind of things chaining off of each other usually is not a common behavior for most legitimate programs. Even if you have administrative tasks that run, they typically don't string multiple things together either. So that's a huge telltale sign. And you can kind of see here's examples of that actually occurring as well. So, yeah.
All right. Whoa. Let's go the right direction. Okay. So let's kind of skip or move into more of that kind of evasion side, right? What is it good for? So we're going to talk, like, in that defense evasion side of this malware family. AMSI bypass through memory is pretty common here. Basically, the way they're accomplishing this is doing a patch of that CLRDLL to force that to force it to have the result of clean inside of the check, basically bypassing the inspection, saying nothing to see here, move on. They do, this malware does leverage various anti-analysis techniques. One I'd love to talk about more, we will near the back end, I think, because I think it's super cool, but it's pretty specific to them. But, you know, tracking the looking for processes for various security tooling, there are many instances in the intel of this occurring. Well, they'll attempt to kill those processes when they're found. Pretty common stuff, but definitely happening here. They also employed, and you can kind of see as you track over time, the evolution of this malware family too. Their move from common basic anti-analysis techniques to getting into the more sophisticated, right? So going from just looking for certain processes and trying to evade them, bypassing AMSI, and then moving into how do I identify sandbox, if I'm in a sandbox, so what kind of techniques would I use? And there's some things that are tracked there as far as some of the processes that are running as well. But there was one that was really cool that I thought, where they used a pretty advanced methodology, a pretty advanced behavior to actually track and require very specific feedback from human mouse movements to make sure that they were in a live environment and a user interacted environment. So one that I thought was pretty cool. I'm trying not to talk more into it because I don't want to give it away yet. And then obviously, you know, in the evasion side, heavy use of that obfuscation techniques and living off the land stuff that masquerading Lee talked about. I think that kind of filters in both into between execution and the evasion part, right? Because there's a reason they're trying to act like a fake Windows update, obviously. So just a couple key points, but I'll toss it to you guys to expand.
So I want to make sure I don't step on what you're trying not to. You're not talking about copy, are you?
No.
Okay, cool. Because that was like one of my favorite things about this. So, you know, we a lot of times when we talk about like the most interesting pieces of an attack, and especially when it comes to malware and how it has to be delivered, malware is probably the one thing that when you think about EDRs and things like that, they're probably best built for because they're kind of going against the payload of things, right? So most of the time, adversaries will change up the delivery to make one, make it successful, but two, make it less obvious. And the second is how do they bypass those initial checks? So then there's like obfuscation that either occurs or stuff they do with the payload with like encryption and things like that. They get past that initial check because if an endpoint tool thinks it's already checked something or can't check something, it doesn't like recheck it necessarily all the time. One of the things that I thought was really clever, and they've done this in multiple instances, when they move the payload, they'll move the payload in parts. And they'll actually use the Windows copy binary or executable. And if you do copy with the slash B, it basically says like binary, and then you can like list all the different pieces and, you know, with a plus symbol in between in the argument, and it will build the payload as a single binary file, like merge all those at the binary level, right? So just taking the ones and zeros. So you're able to basically concatenate all these segments of the payload into one. It's kind of a huge signature, right? Because that is very much not a common thing most anyone ever does. But it's a capability that exists in the OS, and this is why little bins can be very powerful when people understand all those capabilities. So that's a big one. The other, you know, we talked about all the different layers of how it tries to determine the environment it's in or what it's up against, all this stuff before it gets to those key execution points. And I think it's in the earlier variants. I don't know if it's in the later variants, but it just did the traditional task list and then find string approach, where it's going to list things out, it's going to pass things to find string with the different arguments that it's going to provide to look for different security tooling, to look for different potential things executing on the machine, to know if it's in a VM or not as well. So that's kind of common from an evasive standpoint, but it's also very easy to know something's trying to evade on execution, because if something executes and all of a sudden task list kicks off and then find string is kicking off, you know that chain of events is it's trying to learn something about the environment already, right? So that's kind of a key thing there. I think those are all. Oh, I got one more obfuscation thing. And that is, and this I only saw show up in one place, but how it was executed I thought was really interesting. And I don't even know why. I didn't dig in too far, but Basically, there was instance in Windows where they're taking advantage of OpenSSH. It must have, I don't know if it comes natively installed in Windows. Maybe it does now, but it was in the System32 directory. So I assumed it, you know, it's kind of bundled with something. And they actually passed their PowerShell command to the sftp.exe, which you would think has nothing to do with passing commands, but it has the option, if you do the dash O argument, to do a proxy command. So basically what it'll do is it'll execute that, but then it basically runs whatever command is passed with the proxy command argument. So they're not actually using that tool for what it's intended for, other than to execute something else. And they actually passed PowerShell with the command, and it had open brackets listed throughout the obfuscate, you know, and then at the end it does a replace. So it gets rid of all the open brackets. So it just stitches together, and it's basically just PowerShell running MSHTA, targeting a payload on the internet, essentially to basically execute. So similar, right? When we talk about behaviors, right? You can see we've already talked about that behavior before, but we can see how they've changed how they wrap around it to basically do the same thing. So from a machine perspective, when you're looking at execution and things, it looks exactly the same. But maybe from a tooling that has to interrogate something, or from a human perspective, it might not look identical, right? And that's kind of like the big changes you typically see with malware and malware families that are worth paying attention to. So I'll put an example of what that command looks like. And I made sure to kind of neuter the command in it, because it is the associated with the similar payload, but you can't get to it if you were running directly. So that'll be in Discord if you guys want to check it out.
Love that you talked about the, I did have it kind of noted, but I'm glad you ran with it. The kind of like the payload stacking. So I forget the terminology that was used, but basically that bringing in, you know, segmented pieces of a full payload and running that joint, that basically that command to put them all together. It was such a cool technique to see. Pretty easy signal too from telemetry. But yeah, I'm glad you brought that one up, Scott. But I enjoyed looking at that one. Not the one I was talking about though. The one I was looking at really was just the idea to try to evade Sandbox, where they were tracking that mouse movement, and they used they went in depth. You know, there's pretty heavy math leverage to figure out what points of entry or what data points would culminate into a yes or no decision for the malware to either just instantly kill itself or proceed. And it was cool too that in the intelligence that was talking about this, the researchers actually had to figure it out to make the malware continue on. So they got locked into having to solve the math themselves to figure out how to make it execute what it was checking. So it was really cool. It was a really cool read. Sorry, I jumped over you there, Lee.
No, I was gonna say that is one of the most neutered commands I've ever seen. If anyone gets that to run, bravo.
Well, I neutered the URL, but technically if you were to run it, it would just fail going trying to fetch it. But that is basically the command.
Now I'm going to, while researching this, I made a list of all the commands or things it looks for the sandbox. So for the next 15 minutes, I'm going to read them off.
Oh, boy.
That's so small.
It's going to be the rest of the episode.
No, but looking at that, you know, looking at that evasion, it's a lot of the same, which is, again, while it helps, well, it doesn't really help you guess which malware this is. It's a lot of the same techniques that other malware and other actors use. So if you can start looking for these things or looking for indicators of this activity, you know, in your environment, that's a great start. Is you don't know how many different malwares that you could possibly find. Like, you may go, you know, hunting for one using like PowerShell encoded commands, and you think it's one, but then you come to find out, and you're looking at all the behaviors and stuff, it's something completely different, but you still found it, right? And again, harping back to the power of behavioral hunting, that's why we preach it so much.
So one of the other things, that I didn't mention that's interesting, even when it does the task list find string to look for things, right? That whole combination chain. There are variants where when it does that, it will basically output, the results to null. But basically, if it's true and there's no errors, it does basically, and Lee, I think you're the one that originally was creating stuff early days on this because you're Kingpin. But it will pass successfully and then go with no errors to doing a delayed ping to the loopback. And it does like a, like almost like your sleeper technique, right? That delay execution. And so it, and it, it's not for an extremely long period of time because the numbered count is like 181 that they use, but it's basically a ping to the loop back just to delay a little bit of execution before carrying on. So.
Yeah, fun fact, I still use that in almost every workshop I do. It's the most basic, sleeper.
Yeah.
Two last notes
So.
before we kick to the next area. One, King Ping always is effective. It never doesn't work. And we have proof. And then the other thing too, well, just the last point on the invasion side. This goes to that marker we kind of kicked off with when we were talking about malware and malware family. So for this particular malware and malware family, what you would see is this kind of trend over time if you tracked like older intelligence to newer intelligence and analysis for the various campaigns that had this included. You've seen that these evasion techniques, they didn't change, they stacked. So they kept the old code in there, and they would run through it, and they would add in parameters to do the next thing. If there was overlap, one would go first. If failed, then do next. And you would see these things kind of continue to stack in a lot of the versions of the analysis, which I thought was really cool. And then again, that goes back to that, that idea of look for these things, but hold on to them. Some of the behavior type stuff isn't point in time only. It's really like, it's not necessarily this one novel thing. It just keeps sticking and they keep carrying it on and you'll see it again and again. But this area specifically, there was real good definition of that, very good examples of it.
So I would say like that's the one thing to pay attention to if you're ever addressing malware families from my opinion, is if the malware seems to be written modularly, then you can kind of expect brand new techniques, new capabilities, and old capabilities being ripped out, right? Because it's designed that way, right? But a lot of the malware we come across isn't modularly built. It's kind of monolithic. So instead of like trying to re-engineer it, it's band-aids always being applied to current processes, current approaches, and things like that. The only time you typically find something being ripped out is when it has to be. Sometimes it just ends up being like overly obfuscated. So they still do the same thing. It's just obfuscated heavily now versus just out there in the plain. So think about that, and that's something to think about when you think of nation state malware. If you look at a lot of nation state malware, very oftentimes it is modular, and I think it's for that same developmental approach where they don't have to rely on old signatures getting them caught. They can still implement new things over and over again. So this family obviously isn't associated, or I wouldn't assume it's associated with nation state, just based on how it's built. So. Oh, and one thing, and Tom, I thought you might like this because we've talked about how blockchains kind of have plugged into the ecosphere for malware as far as C2, other types of things. So apparently at one point in time, and I feel like this is more near than past, but there's a technique called ether hiding, I guess you would call it, right? And it involves leveraging kind of smart contracts on blockchain platforms, for instance, like Binance Smart Chain, but you can host part of your malicious code, right? So then now you have something that's going to be statically out there and it's in pieces. But if you write now your malware to bypass how you would possibly get detected, you can stitch together your malware by using these blockchain contracts, to pull down those bits and pieces to basically assemble your code, which is, an interesting thing that we haven't really, I mean, it's easy to understand when things go to blockchain exchanges, from a network perspective, but it's kind of hard to get rid of or block or deal with from other avenues. So.
Yeah, it's been a tricky thing too, a little bit tricky because there's been some, I spent some time kind of looking into that piece for the blockchain because it is becoming consistent. Like we're seeing it a lot, particularly focused at Ethereum and Solana, I think are the key two that we've seen. But the one thing I thought would be a good signal to track and kind of go after would be the call outs that are made to go to the blockchain to pull that info off the smart contract, off the message area. But the RPC nodes change, not as fast as IPs, but in a similar vein. So being able to track specifically if it's going to, you know, if it's calling to a wallet, if it's making a call to an RPC node for Solana or Ethereum, they change so rapidly, it's a little tricky. But yeah, it's something to think about. Anybody out there that's being creative, you know, shout and share if you come across any success points going after that. But I think that's going to be a mainstay, Scott. I'm glad you brought that one up. And I believe for this malware family, that was actually a last year thing. That was a more recent one too, I believe. All right. Moving on. Persistence or not? So this particular malware family, the majority of the time does not establish persistence. They really operate in that kind of fast smash and grab model. They're looking to get in, get out, accomplish their goal, and they don't typically establish persistence. And though in the cases that it did, or it was, you know, campaigns did, they were going after very, very common methods for persistence, very simple methods where they were leveraging scheduled tasks and, you know, setting registry run key. These are ones that are routinely talked about by us for sure. People are probably sick of us hearing us say it, but we're not going to stop. We're going to keep reminding you. So it's always in the back of your brain. But yeah, so I thought, you know, this was one I was worried about. This part was what I was worried about giving it away because this could, we could slip and give it away on this one. But yeah, definitely malware that gets in, gets out. It's very good at it too. And it's been established for a bit of time being successful doing that without leveraging persistence mechanisms. So yeah, I'll let you guys explain.
I was gonna say, like, I have some speculation to that. Obviously, it speaks a lot to the motive, right? If it doesn't need to stay, why is it there, right? But flipping that on its head, also thinking about it from the perspective of maybe there are tells where if it is unable to collect what it wants, then it established persistence to hopefully get it at a later point in time. You know, so that might be why we see it sometimes and not other times. I don't know because I haven't actually looked at like the code base or had access to the code base to determine that. But based on the kind of the class of malware it falls in, you know, you'd have to kind of ask yourself that question. And it's kind of good, I guess, to think about is if you do see persistence and is and this kind of class shows up, what it would be the benefit of persisting? And that would be kind of the only thing that makes logical sense to me. But, you know, there could be other things too that I'm not thinking about. But that's kind of where my brain went with that.
I thought this one was really interesting too, because there's, in my mind, there's one class of family that when you say it doesn't gain persistence, I automatically go to. Not gonna say his name because I don't wanna, but also again, talking about what, you know, what the goal is. Whenever you think about no persistence, another thing that pops into my mind is, okay, well, it doesn't appear that this is an espionage campaign. And I, you know, it's calling out because at the same time, like if you're espionage, like, or if you're dealing with some espionage, you know, you're dealing with deep-seated, long-term persistence, and which again goes back to the idea that this doesn't appear to be run by nation states, which in the worst or the best sense of a bad scenario, that could kind of like give you some comfort that, hey, we aren't being targeted by a country that has billions of dollars to target us. You know, granted, we're still, you know, this might be an incident, but at least it's not them breathing down our neck.
Reckless speculation, a little bit to kind of go to both of those points you guys made. You know, as it was referenced earlier, this malware does operate as a malware as a service, right? So I wonder if the variations we also see are relative to, you know,
customer base,
a given customer request or ask or need, which then could in turn lead to it could be nation state potentially leveraging it, right? I mean, maybe.
Service that they definitely, because they just say something like burning a lot of the tool sets, and that they are embedded in the underground the right way. I wouldn't put it past them to try to leverage something like that if they had the opportunity.
Right. All right.
Yeah.
Kicking on. Okay. So what is this malware? What is this malware family after? There are a lot of common stuff here, but there are a couple key clues here that do give away. You know what? Before we hit this, I wanted to ask you guys this one because I thought it'd be a good piece of conversation here. So the poll that just hit the chat, it's what's more valuable early in a hunt? Doing breath or depth? Breath would be scan across your environment, many hosts. Depth would be really kind of targeting and focusing on one host. I like this question. I'm very curious what your guys' opinions are. So I'm going to take a minute to pull away from the topic just to see what your guys' thoughts are there.
Both.
All at the same time?
It's all the same time.
Yeah, no, I'm very much like, for me to like find things of interest to really dive into, I want to like see the big picture. Or at least understand the scale of the big picture, because when I was like a young analyst, I remember having an idea and then start digging into something before I really understood like the scale of it. And I'm like, oh, I think I have something really interesting. And then like, then I took the few steps back and realized like, wow, like I just inserted myself and I'm the needle and I'm in this giant multi-billion-dollar log haystack of all the same things. And I'm like, I really would have done better to understand how I can kind of group or section off some of this so that I'm not like kind of creating a false narrative for myself. So definitely breath for me. But I feel like the more you do depth analysis really refines your approach for breath analysis, if that makes sense, right? Because you get so much understanding that you really know how to handle the breath from doing those deep dives.
I'm going to go the opposite way. I'm going to say depth first, simply because and the reason, I guess, you take a dive on it or you get an indicator from a host, you find this interesting artifact. If it's one of those huge false positive things that you're looking at, you know, say you're just looking for PowerShell encoded commands, right? You find a ton over your environment. The first thing, like, it's like, okay, well, this one specifically dinged on this single host. Let's look at the contextual information. Let's look at the surrounding events. Then once I have some more artifacts on my side, then I can kind of zoom back out and say, okay, well, this host is acting pretty interesting. Like, that's why I got here in the first place. Let's learn more about it. Let's, you know, establish that behavior. And now once we understand that, and maybe it is like certain process creations or process chains, right? Like that explore command to PowerShell. Grab that and say, okay, well, you know, who else is acting like this? Boom. Once you have that artifacts, then maybe you can start getting, you know, more hot spots in your environment or more ideas, and where you say, okay, these, you know, we have five or six other hosts that are acting like this. Maybe now we can see it's a picture of, you know, we got more compromises. This may be a bigger incident, you know, than we think. But that's just my train of thought. I like to understand it. Again, fully, it could go down the route of me making, you know, you're building the story as I see fit versus how it actually is. But understanding like those artifacts, I feel like going depth first is.
Yeah, you know, I also feel like I think tools can influence that approach too. Like what data and tools you have available. Well, I think definitely, because like if you can't deal with things at breath, don't frustrate yourself by trying to do so, right? Like, so you might have to take off bite-sized chunks, but so that might be a big driver. I've been fortunate to at least have enough tools to help with that. They may not have been perfect.
Yeah, I still think I live in your camp, but when I got this, when I really started thinking about this question, because I love that it challenged that that thought process, right? Because it was almost automatic for me. Yeah, go after. You have your data lake or your SIM or whatever. Go after. Go see where it's at anywhere in your environment, right? But I could see the value to Lee's points, and I'm starting to kind of transition and mold that a little bit more now that I'm thinking about it farther of, and I think about times in history, and we together have been in these piles where it's like, throw it at it, see what's out there. And then you get this, you don't get a needle back, you get another haystack, and then you're trying to formulate what's going on. And then in a lot of cases, especially if you do it in a very high level starting point, you're going to ultimately find your way back to that depth part where you're looking at an individual system to try to see what else occurred, because it's never one behavior solves the problem, right? In a lot of cases, you're trying to see what else happened around that stuff in almost all cases. So that depth piece, ultimately, I think now that I am like challenging myself on that, if I'm in an operations area and I'm trying to understand what's occurring in my environment, getting the full picture by focusing on depth first can cast that net very specifically. So when I get that stuff back from my breath, it's not a haystack anymore, and it's very usable. And you can, I can't help but wonder, and you almost wouldn't know unless you do the trial by fire, but I can't help but wonder if that process is actually faster, and we've been going about it in the wrong direction to mitigate faster, you know?
Well, I think it's interesting because I feel like one of the arguments you can kind of drive for that is how often, because if we're dealing with a problem, everything we find we're assuming is bad or wrong, right? But when you were looking before there's a problem, you might be able to say, well, this is normal. Why is this normal? And I feel like the depth on why is this normal gives you so many more insights to help you determine what's abnormal. So when you're doing that breath scan or another depth scan, that's something that you're actually interested in because there's alerts or triggers to it. I don't think there's maybe enough of that going on. I think the depth into like, well, what's normal in my environment, or going down those rabbit holes might actually offer more fruit in a lot of ways.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, sorry to derail. I just thought that was a really
Yeah,
good
you're
one to
good.
have a conversation about.
Yeah, absolutely.
That was a good question, man.
So looking into back to our malware family here, malware family here. What is this malware after? So, common things that we do see malware when they're looking to try to accomplish stuff, maybe collect data, maybe, enumerate your environment, things like that. For this specific one, there's a lot of targeting at browser credentials, at cookies. This malware definitely will leverage for sessions, or it will leverage to accomplish session hijacking. Looking at that autofill data, a lot of the kind of core targets that you see in most of the code, certainly not all, most of the code and the intelligence from campaigns over time for this malware. Going after those Chromium-based browsers, looking for those stored login databases, right? Going after your login files, like skipping my brain, but your DB files that are located in your Chrome directory or Firefox directory that hold those logins. And then some of the unique pointers for stuff that they went after. This malware family was more unique in a couple of these areas. Was it had multiple depths of searching for crypto wallets, so it had like a tier one, tier two kind of approach. It also would search and try to track and gather info from any 2FA extensions you had attached to your browser, which is not super common. And it's a good pointer, a little bit of a tidbit of hint here, but taking a breath, you guys are on.
Yeah, I mean, I think the kind of the trick of the this family and associated families that are like the similar class, right? Is browser executions with weird arguments. And in this case, commonly with this type of class of malware in general, is the remote debugging port, especially I think it's associated with Chrome or Chromium-based browsers. And that's interesting because when you launch that there are a few ports that are available for developers to help them kind of troubleshoot, develop, do what they do in their whole process. And those debugging ports are 9203, 9222, 9229, and 9223. So the 9000 range, right? That are commonly used. But that adds ways to get at data or expose data from the browsers to help with kind of like grabbing of information that it sought after. And I think I mentioned MS Build earlier. The MS Build piece I meant to mention earlier wasn't so much on the malware itself and the delivery. I know I kind of talked about it earlier on, but it was more about how that was, I don't know from the reporting, because I don't remember it being specifically called out if it was injected into MS Build or was leveraging MS Build, but it was actually using MS Build to actually launch browser processes. So either way, looking at weird parent processes to browsers might be a good approach in general, right? Because if you think about the standard user interaction with the browser, it's going to be from Explorer, because that's their ecosphere. That's how they double click. That's how they launch things. So when you start seeing browsers launch from executables or paths that are really weird for executables for browsers, that can be a huge telltale sign for, well, this is non-traditional, and why would something be using a browser which is built for a user, right? Not built for an app, be launched in this way. So good piece to really pay attention to, I think.
Lee, anything to add before I move on?
No, all good here.
All right, pressing on. Okay, some more information that kind of starts diving into, you know, I think we've alluded a lot to the class of malware family this sits in, but it also targets and goes after in variations. This one isn't absolutely all the time. I think this is where this reflects the malware as a service and the actual goal of the individual or actor behind using this malware, but does have code to collect data from, you know, your messaging apps, go after, you know, there's been big campaigns where it's targeted and leveraged Discord, Telegram, so on. Gaming platforms, you might have email client data, FTP data, remote monitoring management software like Anydesk as an example. Kind of see some bullets there. And it looks for those session files, looks for local configuration files, looks for tokens, you know, all of the above. But this one, adding into the whole what it's kind of going after, steering towards that type of family that it is, I think this also expands on the adaptability that we keep talking about as far as it being a malware as a service and how it can kind of really, really pivot from the different things. It's not, and even though we talked about like smash and grab, but we also talked about it would or could establish persistence. In these cases, it's never all of these. And I thought that was just something that was interesting to me to kind of think about more when I'm thinking about a malware and I'm kind of starting to personally create a divide towards what I used to think about a given malware to now how I'm really kind of classifying in my head that malware as a service methodology. And it's getting me to a place where I'm thinking about how to tag or think about my hunts with more effectiveness to a given malware family. I don't know if any of that makes sense. Totally does in my brain, but I don't want to invite anyone in there. But I just thought this talked a lot to it about how the adaptability as the malware as a service and this constant success of this malware family for quite a while, all of that's starting to come together more as I see all the different evolutions of the things it goes after, what it can accomplish, how it can accomplish that. But all right, I'll stop giving you the brain mud. You guys, maybe you can clarify for the audience a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, I was just going to jump on when I see stuff like this, right? Obviously, this kind of calls to the specific class of malware, right? So, it's going after a lot of different things. And when I see this and I think about my environment, either personally or if I'm, you know, working in an organization where we have to keep maybe how we access things somewhat protected or things like that. What's good is there are different tool sets and different logging you can set up to where if something interacts with specific files, right? If a process interacts with specific files for access, for reads, whatever. And if you know your internal processes really well, and you can see that this kind of malware family and class is constantly expanding, right, and growing what the collection method is and what they touch based on what is beneficial, then you kind of know, or if you spend the time doing the research ahead of time, maybe what the next targets could be, or what valuable targets are in your environment anyways, even if they're not part of the list, that you might be able to kind of build up some early detections or alerting or things to look at from a data perspective. And that's what I really glean from this type of behavior in general, is saying kind of anything's game, right? If there's something that there could be access, or something that could be kind of exploited for access, it will likely be a target. So trying to position yourself the best way you can for that, I think, is good. Because honestly, losing your credentials, and it's just like if you got your credit card stolen, it only matters until you change it, right? So, you know, that's why even if you can't protect completely against it from happening, just knowing about it's important enough, because you should have processes in place to make that maybe not necessarily painless, but relatively painless, right? If you get ahead of it.
Yeah, and I love that they included RMM tools like AnyDesk, because it's, and in my mind, like, I guess not funny, but how ironic would it be if you downloaded AnyDesk because someone reached out to you and said, hey, I'm part of your IT help desk, download this, and then you got this malware come in and scrape all the information from it.
Saw somebody else's malware drop.
Right? Well, that would be a crap situation. But yeah, I mean, looking at stuff like this, I always think of, and I know we talk a lot about behavioral hunts, and Paul, you alluded to it, but data-driven hunts too. Like, if you can go behavior, and you could also have the bandwidth to do data-driven hunts, you'll find some really interesting things. And we do that a lot. And there's some fun things that we find out. And yeah, it's not always bad. It's like the question we ask always, does that make sense? What's that? Is that allowed? But not to get you too far off the malware-driven stuff, but if you start doing data-driven hunts, you'll find some things that may be against policy or unwanted programs or things like that. But this picture right here, this is a good, a good indicator that you could use to say, all right, what processes are checking this out, or users or computers or whatever the case would be, you name it. Like, there's a bunch of different ways to aggregate that data. But that's where my mind goes to right away when I see something like this.
Plus, it literally is like a laundry list of, if you're looking at this and you're like, well, where is that data stored? Well, once you learn about the malware, you can look at how it tries to find it. You can use the same thing, locate where these specific files and things are stored, and figure out what access controls are around the files. Is the data in the files plain text? Can you read it? Do you understand? Like, what does that look like from it? So there's a lot you can just learn by trying to mimic the same actions of malware, just to get an idea of, that's how I learn a lot about operating systems in general, right? Is how does malware actors exploit an operating system in order to achieve success? A lot of times I've learned a lot, probably more from actors than I have from just trying to study defensively. So, yeah.
Oh, good points. And to Lee's point about data-driven hunts, just for any of the uninitiated, make sure you have the bandwidth before you open that can of potential worms. And there's been some awesome times going down those data-driven hunts. So where might this be in my environment, right? Like, this, how many people have accessed, like, soft example, the Chrome default login data file, and then you start unpacking some of the crazy things that either your environment does that are just they don't make sense, but that's how it works. Or you uncover a nasty little mud puddle that turns into a level 5 disaster. That's certainly been the case for us in the past, data-driven hunting. So make sure you have the bandwidth when you go down that route, but it's an awesome road to go down.
And start small. Small time frame first.
This is where maybe go depth versus breadth right here in the data-driven.
Absolutely. You'll be so surprised at the false positives you get. Like, sometimes it makes sense where you're like, well, yeah, nothing should be accessing this. And then you run it and you're like, oh my God.
Yeah. Then you, like, it's either panic or like, I was wrong.
Right.
Yeah.
Some custom code that a developer in your company put in 25 years ago still lives and breathes in core functions of your environment.
Using a beta version of the software.
Oh yeah. 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 The .05 version. Yep. All right. Moving on. Okay, so you know, this goes to a bit of the kind of smash and grab. This malware family is typically cored around getting in and out as fast as they can. We're kind of the back end of that, so I think giving a little more of that, echoing that is fine. Local stage data almost always compressed, so it can exfil it as fast as possible. A key thing that's kind of attached to this that I thought was potential signal, and this is of course if you have the telemetry, right? Network telemetry isn't always accessible to a lot of environments, or at least efficient enough to be able to track things down. But if you're lucky enough to have some of that in place, there are a couple key calls to a common methodology used by this malware family, where you will see that post request that is looking for an API endpoint, and it holds that body of act equals life. This was common across so much of the intel in the span of time that the IntelNet was cast for research for this show. So definitely one I thought was worth pointing out. Again, the smash and grab mentality, there's a lot of cases where the exit from initial payload delivery execution running through its process, exfilling the data was in minutes, if not hours. This malware typically operates and is built to operate that fast. It wants to get in and get out. Hence why a lot of times there's not persistence mechanisms, right? And actually want to go back now that we've had that conversation and look at like what common dwell times are and if those ones that have longer dwell times actually maintain persistence. So there's some, I want to know that. So just thinking out loud, but yeah, anything you guys have to add to this one?
I mean, the biggest thing for me is, you know, in today's world, I think everybody, if you have the visibility, should be paying attention to who's connecting to just standard HTTP versus HTTPS. Just because most legitimate web traffic is going to go to HTTPS, for security, but because this is malware as a service, because infrastructure is kind of rotating, moving, and whatever based on campaigns, it's just easier, cheaper, to just do standard HTTP. But that's where when we talk about deep diving in one or having like that breadth approach, right? I feel like this is where having that breadth approach to say, well, how many people are talking to destinations via HTTP? And then start looking at, well, are there a lot of things going? Because that's probably not your problem, but are there a few things going, right? Then deep diving into those to say, well, does that make sense? And then if you have, you know, obviously access to volume of data and size of data, there might be some interesting things there. But that's always like nowadays, I feel like it's always good if you have that telemetry in your environment to be looking at and just kind of having a general sense, right? Of what, even if you have internal business processes that communicate that way, know those. At least you can rule those out because that'll be a majority of your noise, hopefully. But that's usually what stands out to me. Now, granted, that can help you identify not just this bad behavior. It can help you identify a lot of other bad behavior, especially if it's directly to an IP address, because that's almost a common pattern amongst actors in malware as well. But that's probably my biggest takeaway from the way this behaves, as well as, you know, compared to other things.
And to build on that and to go outside this specific malware, really any insecure protocol being used should be definitely looked after. Like, I mean, not just HTTP, but we're talking about, you know, FTP. You see that pop up, like, go, well, again, internal, still kind of shady, but like, again, talk about legacy equipment, talk about, you know, technical debt. But if you see FCP going external, I mean, be aware, because that's probably not good. Any insecure protocols going from internal to external, or God forbid, external to internal, you know, that's something to be always be aware of. And honestly, that's one of the, going back to the data-driven hunts, right? See what's out there, see what it's doing, get know how your environment operates, and you'll be able to figure that stuff out.
Yeah, know your environment for FTP, SFTP type traffic. That's a good one. Everyone should be doing that one, right? Like that goes right into that bucket of one, data dive, two, know your environment. I don't know. We found some fun stuff just chasing that one down in the past. A lot of fun times, a lot of good memories. One
Headaches.
test, what's that? Headaches,
More like
lots of
headaches.
headaches. Many headaches. Yeah, that's where it's like, make sure you have the bandwidth before you open this canister. But you should open this one. This one's a good one.
Because of time, I want to at least get to my story about why I think this malware family kind of drove ClickFix a little bit. And it goes back to when we talked about that MSI execution, right? What's interesting about that is that actually occurred, and I'm sure most people that are at least listening remember the CrowdStrike blue screen across, everything incident. And, that was kind of a catastrophe because people didn't know how to respond, and it's like they feel like they had to touch every machine to recover them and all that kind of stuff. Well, at the same time, because there was that general scare, that's when that whole download this Windows patch and run it with this manual command was pushed to push this malware family using that Windows update MSI install approach. And it's normal because now you're targeting admins and they're used to, if something's broke, having to do an out-of-band patch, right? So you somehow social engineer someone to go to a specific site to where there's going to be a fix, or you have, whatever that is. They're like, oh, shoot, this is where I get this from. Or, you figured that part out. Now all you got to do is provide what command to run to basically have them manually install the software to bypass everything, which is ClickFix today, except for that targeted at incident and administrators. And my guess is the success rate was good enough that they kind of felt like maybe we're onto something, or people were able to see that and be like, we're onto something. And then if you think about it, ClickFix didn't hit the scene too far after that, in my opinion. So I feel like it was kind of like a similar precursor to the same approach, but like, how do we make this work for everybody? And then you even see where some of the ClickFix tricks that we've seen more recently, where they'll make it look like you have a blue screen and it's like, run this thing to run these commands to help fix your issue, just to run the standard PowerShell ClickFix approach, right? And it's just interesting how it kind of falls within that same paradigm. And, I was learning about that specific piece of it when this malware family was kind of really hitting the stage. So yeah,
that's pretty interesting, because I mean, seeing how that morphed into like file fix and like it's just crazy that, again, it worked and then it continued to work, where like, and I think I gotta go back to thinking like how people think whenever they're it's the whole social engineering. Like, We talk about phishing emails all the time. It's the urgency. It's the person it's coming from, right? Now you're giving normal users the ability to help their environment out or help their company out, right? Like, oh, man, my company, or I'm in my company, something's wrong with my computer. I don't have to create a ticket. I don't have to get any admin involved. I don't have to waste their time, and I can continue doing my job. Let me copy and paste this stuff. Boom. Like, great. Now I'm back at it, cutting down time. You're empowering them to do that. When in reality, like, it's just getting rough. You're just infecting yourself.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's and there's maybe a little hint of a behavioral, insider behavioral thing, right? Because I think some of the variants of ClickFix actually add people launch a PowerShell window from the run dialog box that would open the PowerShell window, and then they would paste the command into the PowerShell window. And that's like, hey, if Steve from the call center is opening PowerShell, he's never opened PowerShell once in his entire career here, what's he doing? And it has nothing to do with his role. It's like, you start stitching together some stuff. You could get really creative in your environment to identify suspicious stuff that doesn't on its own look suspicious. But yeah, for kind of like pressing on, because we got about 10 minutes, want to make sure we give enough time for people to take guesses. So, really just this last one is just kind of a closeout to kind of lead into the guess. We talked about the smash and grab. We talked about the lack of persistence, all of the variant things that this malware family can and will target. A lot of stuff we've seen with like credentials and extension data, autofill data, you know, crypto stuff, like plenty of things, and session hijacking too, which is fun to show the variant. But there's a lot of smash and grab, a lot of grab and go. That should kind of speak to the type of malware family this is without fully giving it away. And yeah, I mean, it really does fit into that malware as a service, again, that whole topic, because what this malware can do really does feed to other pieces of, you know, kind of the bad actor realm or the APT Ren or whatever you want to bucket in, right? Malware like this. Yeah, it's really good at getting it, pulling out the oil out of the ground, if you will, and selling it off, right? If it's getting all your credentials, sell it off to an access broker, partner with an access broker, or an access broker leverages the malware and vice versa, right? You know, I think one of you guys actually made the point here about the more and more compromises happen due to valid credentials than historically seen. I don't know. Well, you got either one, you want to expand any of this?
Yeah, I mean, that was, you know, we've kind of talked about this offline before this, when we were talking about this malware class in general. Like, we used to always get faced with this type of class of malware where someone kind of, you know, downloads a plugin or extension for their browser, and we're like, oh, dude, they got this extension and it's stealing their creds or their cookies or their whatever. And the approach back then was like, yeah, so what? Like, how is that really going to affect us as an organization? It might affect them, which, you know, we can let them know, but it's like not the sky is falling kind of incident. Well, you know, that was also back in the times where, at least where we worked, we were kind of in a hardened enclave approach, right? And now with so much cloud and SaaS and like the way people do development and things, yeah, like credentials matter a hell of a lot more. And not everyone just has one credential, right? So then it's like, even if you just have that one point in time credential, or, you know, sometimes we can sit there and say we solve the password reuse thing, but because things are so external to us sometimes, we might not even know. So there's like all these challenges that now stem up that makes this problem that may not have been like a big front and center burning problem, I would say more of a problem today, because of these compromises, where how do you detect someone that doesn't really break in? You know, like that's a lot harder to do than all the efforts and tripwires someone to have to traverse to get in. So I think that's why this malware class has hit the scene so well, and why this malware family has been so successful, because obviously if people weren't paying for the service, it probably wouldn't exist as long as it has. So, you know, it's kind of where
they're doing something right.
Goes right. Yeah.
Yeah. And then we have to expand on the, you know, away from just credential based thinking too, to everything we're seeing with so much of the supply chain stuff nowadays, with the tokens and the secrets and the different things that are as valuable, if not in certain cases more valuable than just a user credential, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I love the picture you painted here of the perfect storm of the initial access to help, you know, empowering the person to what they're after, to the initial access broker, to reinfection, different malware, possibly. Just that cycle just is crazy to me. But again, like you said, it goes to show why this keeps working, how powerful this could be if
yes,
like detected or not.
I really feel like the underground has turned into what malls used to be in our childhood, where actors could like just go to this place and there's all these stores and they can kind of do whatever they want, hang out. When before it was like really hard to find those stores. I just feel like that's what the underground seems more and more like, with the way these communities interact and what they do. Yeah.
You know? I've said this all the time with the ransomware gangs. I feel like they operate better and more cohesively than most organizations, or I should say legitimate organizations, do.
Yeah, their annual get together is probably a blast.
Yeah, I mean, they got millions of dollars, they got yachts, yeah, they got
their Lambos. Yeah,
yeah. Well, it's like your own dollar, right?
Man, that's crazy to think about. We'll not go black hat. All right, everyone, well, we got a couple minutes left, so we want to make sure we give everyone time to kind of open up and close out the the guest portion. So we're going to redrop the link here in the chat so you can go out and submit your guests. Remember, you're only going to be able to submit one. And we will, the first five correct submissions will receive a t-shirt. So they will close. The submission is going to close here in about 5-6 minutes as soon as we close out the episode. So we give you time to go out and do that. And I guess in the meantime, just for a couple minutes here, do you guys want to chime in on the last poll? It might be a solid little end conversation for some tidbits. Which signal would you trust more for detecting data theft? A suspicious process accessing user directories, or a process making outbound HTTPS requests? You guys care to chime in on that one?
So I'm not gonna, I said HTTPS. I think I'm the only person that did. But so like looking at users' directories, I feel like, and even local data storage wouldn't really detect theft for me right away. But if I start seeing calls externally, even over HTTPS, of course, you're going to have to do your false positives and work your way through and, you know, really look at the data and what you know, where it's reaching out to, et cetera. You have to do all that analysis. That tells me that, okay, this is actually leaving. Now, suspicious process accessing user directory, I feel like that would be a great precursor behavior to understand that, yes, something is happening here, but to actually point to say someone like, yes, our data was lost, our data was stolen, here's the artifact that shows me why. And that's kind of how I read it. Like, if you would point to something and say, did someone steal your data, I could be like, this HTTP request that was this size to this strange IP or proxy or whatever, that was the indicator that it was stolen. Now, then let me paint the picture for you. Here's where it was being stored. Here's the directories that they found. Now we can narrow it down to what was actually stolen.
Yeah, the love to go ahead and look at HTTP post request to, you know, you're in a maybe a financial company or, you know, something like that, and you randomly catch a post request going out to like religioussite.x or some random thing. You're like, that might be bad. This might not be a good thing. Let's go ahead and track that up. Sorry, Scott, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, like, I think that the challenge for me in this question is I want to say I would care more about the user directories because I think in bulk you would see a lot of access happening, not just, like, on the, like, periodic stuff. But the telemetry for both these potentially could be hard to get, tying a process to a request depending on what kind of tool sets you have, or tying a process to file or directory type access, depending on how you have your environment configured. So you kind of have to be ahead of the game to know how to either get that stuff set up or know about it. But I mean, I think they're both good. I think it might be easier from the HTTPS request to identify weird processes because there's going to be your standard stuff that usually talks to the network from an OS, an application specifics that you can compare across the environment very quickly versus things that access user directories that could be across the board depending on what applications users have installed, what they interact with directly. So I can see that potentially being a lot harder to run down, except for if there's a volume of it, right? So the volume speaks, I think, pretty loudly.
I like the idea of the question too. What I thought it was going to bring up is just to get, you know, your brain kind of spinning on it, because if you take either of those approaches, in most cases, you're going to find your way down a different next step from it, right? So it could potentially lead you into an investigative direction left or right. Eventually, I think you merge if it's all related to activity, but when you start at point A or point B, you're going to go either left or right, which is something to consider when you're thinking about where do I kick off my investigation. But yeah, just a nugget. I know we're at time, Scott, so.
Yeah, go ahead.
Kicking it over to you.
Oh, you on
view for closeout? Oh yeah, I failed to get a pretty slide here, so it's gonna get a verbal reveal. So.
Oh man, I could have done a beautify on a slide and make it.
No,
in the
no.
Super AS.
Epic Tom fail.
All right, well, as for those, if you haven't got your guesses, then get them in quick because the big reveal is Luma Stealer, the Luma family. So if you guys guessed that, congratulations. Obviously, there's a lot of stealers that act very similar in a lot of ways. Luma, try to call out some distinct things that may help narrow in on the Luma. But hopefully this is beneficial to those that were listening. Hopefully that people walk away learning something and had something that they can potentially use. And if you guys are familiar with Luma, hopefully we also covered it well enough to say, yeah, and that lines up with what I know. So I guess appreciate everybody's time. Listen to us talk about everything, dive into some things, and I guess we'll kind of end it on that note. Looking forward to syncing back up with our normal weekly segments in the upcoming weeks. So happy hunting.